Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to episode 138 of our podcast. I am Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop, and I'm here with my co-host, Diami Plotke of the Penultimate Woodshop. And tonight we're talking to Jeremy Wright. You may know him from such things as sticking a microphone in your face at Handworks 2017. How's everybody doing?
Pretty good. You may also know me from Uncontrollable Laughter at the Handworks 2017.
Oh. <laughs> Yeah.
I'm kind of one of those loud laughers people. So
I was thinking that you find handworking funny also.
Yeah.
That's all right. Let's get into our normal rigmarole. Diami, I kind of have a feeling I know what's in your shop, but what you got going on?
Why don't you tell me, Sean?
Well, it looks like you have made a massive leap forward in progress on the vice that we spoke about so many episodes ago.
I have. Is it the last time we actually sat down for an episode? I think it may be.
I think it was.
You hadn't started the last time we recorded an episode.
Yeah. I made the bench, and I'm reaching over it. Oh, wait. Oh. It's top heavy. I'm reaching over away from the microphone to grab it. It's I went the route that I was considering. Basically, I'm copying, in terms of the bench construction, I'm copying Shannon's joinery bench. Mine, the bench top, is made out of a massive LVL. That it was about 22 inches long by, I don't know, it's like 3 inches thick by 14 inches wide, something like that. It was a big, heavy, it was a cutoff of a big LVL. And I ripped it apart and I glued it back all up together. So now I've got a bench top that is, I believe it's 22 by 22. And as I'm looking at it, I haven't even squared the edges yet. Like the one edge is all zigzaggy as the pieces are not quite all the same length. And it's about 3 inches thick. I think it's 3 1/4 inches thick, something like that.
And that's plenty for the vise?
It's plenty for the vise. I also figured I was trying to get at about the 3 inch mark, because my understanding is that that's the sweet spot for holdfasts. I know I've got holdfasts in my bench now, but my bench top's only about 3/4 inch thick, and it doesn't quite do with the job it should.
I can vouch for that. Mine's about 1 inch thick, about the same.
Yeah. So the top's all glued up. The pattern maker's vise is set in the top. Now there's six screws that attach this hinge mechanism of the pattern maker's vise to the bench, because the pattern maker's vise swings up and down. And I've just temporarily screwed them in with wood screws. I do need to replace those wood screws with lag bolts, which will give it a little bit more permanent attachment. I should never be able to rip it out at that point. But I'm going to do that one at a time once it's turned over and in place, because right now it's still upside down, which means that the screws that go in through the top are up through the bottom. It's just, I think with it actually set up as a bench, it'll be easy to swing the vise out of the way, pull one screw out, put in a bolt, and just do that one at a time, and it should be fine. So that's the top, and the top has been done for about a week with the vise in it. And what I've spent the last few times in the shop on is the legs. So I got to give a shout out to, I should probably give a shout out to Bill Lutz, because I don't think you're allowed to do shout outs without mentioning him. But really to his podcast mate, Phil Pinsky, because I was making the top out of this reclaimed LVL, really because I had it, not because it was reclaimed. And Phil and I went back and forth, and he was encouraging about it. And then I asked him about my legs. So he kind of prodded me on to make the whole thing out of reclaimed materials. So I liberated a couple scaffold planks, and I've milled them down. At least where I live up in the Northeast, scaffold planks are the only good source of Southern yellow pine. So I've milled them down, and the pieces that I'm making the legs out of now are, they're 1.5 inches thick by probably 5 inches wide. Something like that.
Okay.
I haven't made them to any specific width. I took the scaffold plank, which is, it's 11.5 inches wide, a regulation scaffold plank.
Two by 12.
It's technically, it's a 2x12 with these rods stuck in the end to stop checking.
Right.
And it gets an OSHA stamp on it. So you cut the ends off because you can't use those rods. And then I ripped them in half and I milled them. So I've got the legs.
So how are you going to join that to the top?
With, I left them in the attic. I grabbed the screws with timber, timber framing screws. There's the screws that get used for like, for decks. They're made by OMG Manufacturing is a fastener manufacturer, and they have different brands for different markets. And I don't remember what their brand is for like deck framing, but that's what they're these really heavy duty screws that can be used in place of lag bolts when you're assembling a deck.
Like specs.
Yeah.
They're like specs, but
that's what we'd have around.
But much heavier than a specs. Like I have specs that are like number 2 and number 3 up to like number 10. These are probably a number 16. And the ones that I grabbed are 4.5 inches. So I may have to grab my 6 inches. I've got them in 4.5 and 6. They're what I use to assemble the shop walls. And that's, I'm going to use them simply to attach the legs to the underside of the bench.
Just toenailing them in?
No. I'm going to drill right through the roughly 5 inch depth of the top stretcher.
Oh, okay.
So the on the legs, the top stretcher is flush with the top of the leg. The bench will rest directly on it, and I'll screw right up through it into the underside of the top.
Yeah, there would be a stretcher. I think I was missing.
Yeah,
that.
I didn't even think of a stretcher either. I was thinking of just legs going onto this thing.
This is not a root bow joinery bench. I actually have stretchers. I'm not tenoning them in. Yeah, so anyway, that's where I stand. I ran into a small snag at the hardware store because the stretchers to the legs are joined with just lag bolts. I didn't bother doing any joinery. It's just a face. It's just a face joint. I didn't even put glue in it. At this point, I put 2 small screws in to hold it exactly at 90 degrees, and I'm going to put lag bolts through it. But the 3.5-inch lag bolts I bought were actually only 3 inches, so I had to go back to the hardware store today, and I haven't had a chance to bolt them together.
Aha.
So that's a long story as to what's going on with the vice.
But it's good to hear that you're making quick progress with it. I mean, it seems to be progressing.
Well, you know what it is? I carried about 2 weeks ago now. My friend came over and we carried the slabs for the entertainment center up out of the attic into the shop. So right now, stretching across, it's underneath the computer as we're recording right now. It's stretching across the table saw and my outfeed support are 4 12-inch by 1.5 by 12-foot slabs of timber strand that are going to be the entertainment center. So they just take up the whole shop, and now I'm really committed to finishing the entertainment center because I can't really use any of my tools until these things are done. But the joinery bench where it is now, the pattern maker's bench, it's turned upside down sitting on top of my shop garbage pail. So I just need the space. So I have to finish the damn thing and get it put away so that I can actually walk in the shop.
There you go. Motivation.
Yeah, exactly.
However you want it.
Exactly. So that's what's going on in my shop. What's going on in your shop, Sean?
Well, I took a trip to my dad's house, and I think I mentioned it last time we recorded. So I took my Festool sander up there, and I'm happy to report that it passes the dad test. He hooked it up to a dust deputy and took 220 directly to a rough sawn piece of rock maple, and in about 5 to 10 seconds, it was baby butt smooth.
Wow.
And he wasn't pressing hard. So, I mean, he just ate right through it. That, you know, quiet, soft. He was like, oh, it's soft starts. Oh, you know, he's like, you know, Liz looking at Festool. He goes, oh, those things are expensive. I said, well, this one wasn't. You know, this one's affordable. He's like, man, he goes, he left it with the thinking that he commonly lives by is, so if you were to do this once, I would definitely go this route. I was like, all right, I guess it's what Festool's known for too. I mean, it's invest and it's going to last you a long time and work well. While I was there, I didn't get to test out. We were a little pressed for time, but I got to get my hands on the, that Oneida universal dust free router hood.
Okay.
And it's slick. So it says universal and obviously nothing's going to be 100% universal. There's no way it's going to work on any trim router that I can tell. That's mainly because the plate that you mount to the bottom of your router, or as the bottom.
I was going to say, it replaces the existing base plate?
It replaces. And there's a whole series of slots and holes to fit a whole bunch of different configurations that I'm sure fits most standard benchtop routers.
But like, it would be as simple as drilling a hole and countersinking it in the plastic to make it fit anything, right?
Yes.
But that's going to be a little tricky to get it centered, and it's harder than it sounds, but it's absolutely doable.
Well, then it gets a little more complicated when that plate is actually two pieces.
Oh.
So that's how the dust shroud and the edge guide work. They're clamped. Well, they're not directly clamped. The dust shroud itself, or the dust hookup itself, is actually pinched between two plates. That's how it allows it to swivel but still work.
And that hookup is what would go above the base plate around the top, and that's what the hose is going to connect to, all above the base plate.
And the reason I say that wouldn't work for a trim router is because it kind of comes right up the middle around the bit,
okay,
and then jumps through the frame, that hole that's in any typical router.
Right.
You know, there's probably one on either side, you know, most of it, maybe, you know, a grand majority of it, but it kind of has to thread up and in there, and then you screw the base plate on. And so it has to be super tight for anything like the little DeWalt or the Bosch, you know, trim style routers. But anyway, and then it's got two different edge guides for presumably two different depths of bit.
Now, let me stop you for a second. When you say edge guide, it's not a guide per se. It's a shroud, right?
It's a shroud. It's a shroud for like an end bit. So if you were like trimming laminate, you know, and you got the bit that just kind of sticking out there, this thing, both of them are kind of shaped like kind of spoon shaped. So they're roundish, hemispherical around where the bit is, and then it cups down a little lower. There's two different sizes, and those in the void, kind of where the dust shroud is on the top side, there's a little lip on the inside where the two plates squeeze together, and you can just pinch the little lower shroud with your fingers and click it in place, and then at that it swivels freely.
Okay.
Once it's in place. So it's really slick. It's four pieces and however many screws it takes to attach to your particular router.
Are all the components clear?
Yes. Everything was absolutely clear.
Okay.
100%. So from what I could tell, if you would get this in place, again, I didn't get to test it out, but if you were to put it on any one of your routers, the only things blocking your view would be the arms of your routers that go down to the base.
Right. So it's going to make things a little hazier, but it's not going to really block the view of anything that you wasn't already blocked.
No, and I'm assuming any router with a downlight on it would light this thing up, and you'd be clearly seeing the surface underneath. Okay. And at $30, I would encourage anybody to get it just because it's a cheap. I didn't get to test its performance, but I can only assume. But you know, how it did, I mean, it really surrounds the bit area pretty big. You couldn't put like your William Ings big old bit in there. There's no way that would fit. But any reasonable for anything up to probably a 3¼ horse router, you know, probably under an inch and a quarter or so would work in where that shroud is, where the dust collection actually happens.
Okay, now
because it plunges right through it.
Two questions.
Yes.
The fitting that connects to the vacuum hose.
Yes.
What size is it? What size hose does it take?
Without putting micrometer on it, the small size.
So, like the hose from the CT vacuums would fit in it. It's that whatever that is.
It's smaller. Is that like an inch and a quarter?
I think that's an inch and a quarter.
Inch and a quarter, inch and a half. Yes, it's that. It's that small. He had an older hose. I don't know where it came from, and it fit around it, with a loose fit, but enough to keep it in place and turn on the vacuum, and it held there. And we were moving the sander all around, and it didn't shake off.
Okay.
I'm sure there are better, and that's an older. I think I've seen that hose all my life, so I'm guaranteeing that end rubber is in bad shape. But I didn't hook it up to anything else. It's definitely not any bigger than that. It's the smaller. What comes with, I think your standard, not shop vac, but the littler ones.
Right.
Again, I mean,
the standard dust extractors. I know the Bosch, the Porter cable, when there was the Porter cable, and the Festool, all of the same size small fitting, which I think is an inch and a quarter.
Yeah, I think that rings a bell. And either way, I mean, I'm sure the the Rockler multi attachment obviously makes that easy. But there's definitely a way to get this to work. It is really slick. Doesn't weigh but ounces. It's probably more fragile than most bases because it's thin. I think it's a 5.5 or 6 inch circle.
Okay.
Once it's clamped down, it's all kind of key weighed into itself. So that's going to be a solid connection once you bolt it to the router.
And then
the dust collection will move and your little bottom shroud can move around.
Wouldn't be able to use the top shroud without their base plate.
No, not easily.
Okay.
The way it grabs way it's held in that inner ring is kind of special to them. I think it has a lip that it rides in that you'd have to find a way to.
Will it accept bearings?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean, the whole thing, that plate can't be a strong 3/16 thick total. It's very thin.
Okay.
And that's two pieces getting sandwiched together. Maybe it's a quarter if those are 1/8 inch pieces of plastic. And then there's little just cutouts, again, shared areas where the bottom shroud and the top hose connection get into and then can rotate around in.
Cool.
So, yeah, I encourage anyone.
So, Jeremy, what's been going on in your shop?
In my shop? Well, let's see. Right behind me now, I have a Dutch tool chest that's about it's all put together. I still got to do all the guts stuff on the inside yet.
Now, if it's a Dutch tool chest, am I right that it doesn't count as finished until you paint it?
Yeah, it
will have to be painted. Yeah, which I haven't quite figured out yet.
And I believe it has to be milk paint.
It will not be milk paint. So I haven't figured out what I'm going to do that, what kind I'm going to paint that yet. Actually, the finish of my choice of late has been the charred blowtorch finish on lots of my projects have been that, but I don't think this is out of pine, so I don't think I'm probably going to do that. I'll paint it somehow, but
just burn it down.
Yeah, that's what's going on there. My daughter decided she wanted to make some picture frames for some posters she has. So we started working on that. So we kind of milled up a bunch of stock and made some molding. That's sitting on my bench now. Then it's June, and I don't know if you guys heard Brian Eaves. He tries to get a group to do a June chair build.
Yeah.
People just build a chair somewhere in June. Anyway, so I'm planning, since I was totally pumped up for it last year and then totally did nothing on it, besides do a little design work. I decided that I think I got a couple of things in the works there. I think so. And I also put one of the new Benchcrafted swing seats on my bench just the other day.
Oh, yeah. How's that working out for you? Did you pick it up at Handworks?
I did. Yeah, I did. It's very nice. It's really nice. And I thought it was very, I'll be honest, I thought it was really expensive.
What is the price tag?
They are $199 at the show. I think there was a little discount or something going on. I don't know. It seemed like I got more change back than I expected. maybe it was a miscount or maybe it was intentional. I don't know. If Jameel's listening to this, don't.
I'll send him a Thank you, Jameel.
Thank you, Jameel.
I did some research on some other alternative ones. Man, they're out of sight as far as the price on those.
Oh, really?
They're like $300-$500. Wow. It's like crazy. Yeah.
I've not seen one in the flesh, but I've seen many of the other Benchcrafted pieces. I'm assuming it's fabricated at the same standards, right?
Oh, yeah. It's really nice. I mean, it's like two castings and two pins. So it's not like there's a whole lot of finished work. But I mean, it's nicely designed and it swings beautifully. And, you know, we installed perfectly and was really nice. But I mean, as far as like the level of precision, I mean, it's precise, but I mean, it is like two castings. So it's
right.
Like
right. But
yeah,
I'm assuming the pins are milled. No.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's real nice. I mean, the pins, I mean, nice high tolerances. There's no like wobble or slop or anything. I mean, and I was kind of concerned just with my my unexacting tolerances of my garage floor or my bench that it would kind of want to swing open or swing closed. Mm-hmm. But it goes and stays exactly where I wanted it. So
oh, that's great.
Is there a bushing in it, or is it just the castings in each other?
It's just the castings.
So can you lift the seat right out of it if you didn't want it in there? Okay.
No, it's like two hinges.
Okay.
If you imagine it like that, with a clevis on the top and the bottom.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Yeah, I've looked at those. I don't have a bench to put one on, but intriguing.
Does it change the what you're looking for out of a bench? Like, I don't know of any bench design philosophy that is designed to have a seat added to it.
So seating.
Well, I absolutely understand how it just screws on and is an easy add-on. I'm just wondering, does the undercarriage of the bench get in the way so you can't like belly into it, or does it screw up your heights? Does it work, I guess, is really the question, because it looks really cool. I'm just not sure how that would change the interaction with the bench.
Well, we'll see. I've only had it on it for a couple of days. Okay. I did give quite a bit of thought to the height that I wanted it to be at. So I had a kind of a saw bench that I had, and I stacked a bunch of one bys on top of it until I got to kind of what I decided was the right height for working at.
Okay, that's probably important.
And figure that out. Because it's static at that point. So that seems to work out. I think you can. Of course, it swings in just an arc, so you're limited on where your seat is. And I'm a little bit unsure because most of the time I tend to stay towards the end of my end of the bench that has my vise on it. So this would be at the other end, essentially, so it doesn't interfere with the vise.
Okay.
With my face vise. But I think it's going to work out well. If not, I've got a shop bench that I can, or a shop stool I can move around wherever wherever I want to. So I think it's just kind of an additional seat that it's a nice to have luxury for the shop. And half the time for me, it's like my stool somewhere else in the shop moved somewhere else or covered with junk, and this is kind of has to stay free because it's loose.
So. As long as you swing it underneath something so that it doesn't become that flat surface that catches.
The thing is, though, is that it moves so readily that you can't really put something on there for more than just a second. I mean, you wouldn't. I would be hesitant to like stack junk on top of it just because I know that if I bumped into it, it will swing and everything will come crashing off of it. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh, very cool. So I don't know if you guys saw. Diami, you got a chance to talk to Nancy Hiller, and she's got her new book out.
Yes.
But did you see that Nick Offerman put up like a positive review of it?
I did see that. He seems to like
that's,
it. It's a very good book.
Yeah. I mean, that's high praise.
Yeah.
Not only an author of another, newer, well-received woodworking book, but I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I'd say also the fact that like Lost Art Press is putting it out there.
Yeah.
I've yet to read it, and I didn't get to meet Nancy while at Handworks, but all I've heard is just a lot of positive things about the book, and it just seems it seems out of the ordinary for other people to carry it or have such high praise for I have to say I have only heard about Nancy when she was on when she was on your podcast, so maybe a year ago. I'm trying to think when that was.
Yeah,
she was on just under a year ago. She was on the lead up to WIA. Mm-hmm. The book. It sounds like I'm the only one of the three of us who's read it.
I haven't had it.
It's wonderful. I related to it as a woodworker and just as a contractor, because that's what I do during the day. Anybody who makes things and who tries to make a living making things or selling things is going to be able to relate to it. It's autobiographical in the fact that it's stories from her life, but it's not so much trying to tell you her story as so much as a craftsperson's story, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very well written, and I would certainly encourage people to pick it up and read it. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Absolutely. It's on my Christmas list, if not something sooner.
Yeah. The more I hear about it, the more I realize I'm going to have to pick it up.
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's get to the meat of this episode, and we've hinted to it obviously a few times already. But Jeremy, you got to go to Handworks this year, so Where do we start? How was it? let's start with how far did you travel? Where are you from? And right, where was Amana, Iowa to you?
I'm from Central Illinois, so it was probably just a little under 4 hour drive.
Okay.
For me. So it wasn't bad at all. This is the third time I've been there. And actually this is the only woodworking event I've been to. So
that's a pretty good one, especially if you're in that hand tool kind of shade.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Yeah, so some of my comments will probably be prefaced with the fact that, you know, I haven't been to any of the WIAs or anything like that, even though I've wanted to get there, just haven't yet. So
someday soon. I guess the price tag for Handworks, if it's a 4 hour drive away, is perfect.
Yeah, it's really nice. It's also
hotel room, right?
Yeah, and from where Iowa is to where I am, there's kind of not really a great way to get there via interstate. I have a little roadster that I like to drive for a little road trip. So it's been nice when I've gone. It's kind of been an excuse to kind of take a weekend and just take a drive. So
nice.
It's kind of nice. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. I would say I drove to Iowa last May, but it was in a rental car. So I drove a Nissan. That was great. Down the turnpike the whole way.
Versa, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. But yeah, and before we get into it, it was just kind of funny to me. This is completely unrelated to Handworks directly, but Facebook, you know, has that like this day in your history on Facebook thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this day in 2011, 6 years ago, I was at the Sindelar Tool Museum.
Oh.
And where is that?
That's in Michigan.
Near Battle Creek, Michigan, I think. Yeah, I just happened to be over there. I drove there on a whim, and there's a bunch of pictures on Facebook. I should probably reshare that so people can find it.
I don't know that he's still around. I got a chance to go there a few years ago too, and that was just something else.
It's so cool.
Yeah,
that was I went there because they had his roving show at the first WIA I went to.
Okay.
And that he had a trailer all painted up, and I was like, oh man, that's an hour from my house. Done. And so I checked it out. That was kind of funny. But anyway, so Handworks, third time going. Tell us a little about the Amana Village before we dig into that. I've heard it is historic. It was something of a, what was it? It was a shaker, not a shaker.
Some sort of
German something.
Yeah, right? I would say that I am not the best versed in that. What it was?
Okay.
It was something. Where there was sort of these kind of common areas, kind of colonial or communal groups that were religious in some way. You could definitely get a vibe. It's definitely, you know, away from cities. There's not really it's very cultural, very, 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 small town feely, very, very nice. Everything's really, well kept, but it's very like, feels like almost like a movie set in the way that it's so cult. Well, I shouldn't say that because it's a little town. It's just very quaint. It definitely feels a throwback. There's absolutely no major chain kind of things. I think there's a Casey's on the far side of the Central Colony where we were at, which is a gas station in the Midwest parts. But there's, you know, everything's a little small mom and pop kind of little restaurants and things like that. It's really, you know, there's a garden ornament shop across the street from the barn that was at one of the places. There was, you know, there's a fudge shop. There's a meat shop. It's just lots of little small businesses. I get the feeling that it's sort of a cultural destination for kind of the two big cities there that are bigger cities, mm-hmm. Iowa City and Cedar Rapids or Rapid City. I can't remember which one it is.
Was there boarding in town? Could you find a hotel? Or did you have to travel out of town to places?
There was some boarding. It's really tricky though. The places that are around book up immediately because I think a lot of them are just the vendors. I think Jamil probably it lets them get an advanced booking on that so they can be close by. Yeah, I'd hope so. And there's just not that many rooms in this in the immediate colony. Then there's a few other little colonies that are kind of close by, as well as then there's, you know, I stayed in Cedar Rapids. I can't even remember where it was, Grand Rapids or Cedar Rapids. And it was, you know, 15 minutes away.
Oh, that's
it was,
not too bad.
It was not bad. I mean, it was, then you're in a different city, but as far as travel, it's no big deal whatsoever. You could easily stay in Iowa City or the other place. So
was it a tourist destination, right? By its own right.
Yeah.
Kind of. I mean, I know. I get it. Was there anything else going on when Handworks was going on that you could tell? No quilting guild meeting or anything.
I can't really necessarily say that there was anything going on. Although I'm sure they sure could, you know, benefit from setting that up to have some synergy going on with all the woodworkers and all their wives, you know, a knitting circle or a quilting bee or something going on there. They'd probably do well. There was a quilting shop. I walked by and my daughter wanted to go in because she thought it might be warm inside. So we went in there for a couple minutes. There was, you know, several little kind of like that kind of crafty kind of, you know, country kind of feel shops in town. So it's, you know, very, very quaint, very fit right in with what the persona of the event was, you know, kind of celebrating craftsmanship and handworks and high quality stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. So how was the, was there one venue or one barn more?
Yeah, so probably there was on the first year there was a handwork, so that's 2013. Everything was in this one barn. It was probably about the size of a kind of a squished out high school gymnasium, you know, like long stretched out. It's pretty big. Then the last one, they took that and then probably maybe a two blocks over, they had a couple of things in one shop, and then another two blocks over, kind of a triangle, they had the Greenwood barn. And then this year they added another two buildings, the blacksmith shop, and there's some other one that's kind of connected by the blacksmith shop, and I'm probably missing another barn or something.
Is this
basically spread out? Go ahead.
Is this all on a single campus, or when you say two blocks, this is like in the middle of town?
Like a town. Yeah, but there is no like, the only cars are people that are there for that event. I mean, it's all walkable. It'd be like, I don't even know what to compare it to. You know, it's just a really small town. I felt totally comfortable letting my daughter run, you know, walk around and go out and do her own thing. It's just very calm and peaceful, and you can just walk kind of two or three blocks. And I say blocks, I mean like, you know, three or four houses in a block kind of thing. And there'd be, you know, a fudge shop, and there'd be a pizza place, and there'd be a coffee shop, and you know, you just kind of go between the two.
I'm sorry. I'm just looking at a map, trying to get a sense of what's what. And it really is, it's streets and housing, or buildings, crazy.
Yeah. I don't know how much it was really housing. I'm sure there is some houses there, but I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of shops, a lot of bed and breakfasts, a lot of that sort of thing. So it was hard to tell what was really people there. Yeah.
The touch of home, bed and breakfast. Fudge store. Yeah. I mean, it's quaint is I think the right word. Cause it's all just like kind of a tilted block of stuff.
Yep.
No, that's pretty cool. Did you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to say there's not a formal admission to this, right? So you just kind of show up in the little town and walk through into the different areas.
That's exactly true. Yeah. I mean, there's a little donation box when you walk in, if you want to contribute something, that's just right there. And otherwise you can just wander around. You can, you know, talk to people and go from venue to venue. There's not really, it's theoretically a marketplace, but you know, I see more people jabbing on that are with the marketplace people than you know, a lot of, selling stuff. So even though I'm sure there was lots of stuff sold.
Do you think that's a symptom of that being your third time that you didn't walk away other than with a swinging bench seat?
I did walk away with some other things.
Okay. So you still got bitten. That's good.
Yeah, actually, I probably bought more this time than the previous two times.
Okay.
The last time, I think I bought a lot of stuff from Patrick Leach. I followed his list for a long time, and of course, read many of his things on his Blood and Gore. There, I hadn't really interacted with him much, and then to see like all these vintage tools, like you know, mm-hmm. that you see, and so last time I came home with quite a few vintage tools. This time, though, I came home with the swing seat. Let me think what I came home with my name on a couple lists for future tools, and let's see, I came home with. What did I come home with? I came home with a Texas Heritage mug.
I came home with
some sticks of Brazilian rosewood that Conrad Sauer was selling. Man, it seemed like there's a few other things. I can't say that I came home with a lot of really the high dollar stuff, but most of the stuff there that's high dollar, you're putting your name on the list because they're backed up or that sort of thing. Or books,
yeah.
And that sort of thing.
I mean, there was some cool stuff going on there. I followed it, you know, fairly well. I was out of town that weekend, but like I know Mike Simpson brought a mm-hmm. bench or assembled a bench there, and they just put a thing out there that said, "First come, first serve. It's yours for free." And I'm like, "Oh,
yeah."
And it was like a German style bench, you know, one that they screw together, and I'm sure you could make it out of 2x12s. But still, I mean, like that was. That was one thing going on. Did you get to all the different venues in the blacksmith shop and everything?
Oh,
this
yeah.
time around?
Yeah, I definitely did. Although I didn't get to speak to all of the vendors this time.
Right.
Although I think I probably spoke to most of them this time, or if I hadn't, I had spoke to them last time. But yeah, there was a few other events. Mike Simpson was also. They did like a build your own Mox and Vice. Sort of class. I don't know if you want to call it that. I don't know. It was just kind
with
of like
what,
a station.
With what hardware?
He was making his own. They had some thread boxes, and
cool.
it was pretty neat. I think that he probably wished he would have brought more stuff because I think he was all done with all of the stuff he had on about halfway through Friday. So,
oh my
gosh. Yeah, there was quite a bit of traffic at different times, and he was in a one of the buildings that was closed up, so he was not in the barn. He was in the furniture shop. Mary May was in there, and then reproduction Studley chest was in there.
I wanted to talk about that. I saw a lot of people's close up photos of it, and it was weird because the last time I was there, I saw a bunch of distant behind plexiglass photos of, and this thing looked like, I mean, from my vantage point, the real deal. I mean,
it was incredible.
Jimmy, I don't know if you saw it, but someone, and I don't know the gentleman who made it.
Him. I interviewed him.
okay. You'll hear him. Awesome. So, it's a reproduction of the Studley tool chest, I'm guessing from the book, right? So he took I wouldn't say inspiration, but information from the book that Lost Art Press did on the Studley tool chest, which was again at the last Handworks on loan. But that thing is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And so to have somebody put it in, was it full working? Could you get up and like lift its flaps and move it all?
You couldn't.
Okay.
He and his wife were doing some demonstrations at different times. And he was definitely moving things around. And he was happy to talk about it all. In that way, I did go to the 2015 showing for the Studley. And that was incredible, of course. But like you say, it was behind glass. You know, you just kind of. It was awe-inspiring, but this was in that way so much better because you could just, you know, you get 2 inches from it, and just so long as you didn't, you know, get your nose smudge on it, he seemed to be okay with it. And you could just really see that, and he was, you know, moving things around, taking pieces out and, you know, talking, and you know, you could see things in dynamic motion. And from all different angles and really up close. So it was really, in that way, I think it was more impressive. And it was certainly spot on. I've got that book from the Lost Art Press, and it, you know, that's, he said that he built it just from that. He didn't have any measurements. I mean,
wow.
he said that there's enough detail in there that anybody that needs to make it should be able to do it.
Looking at it, I can't believe he didn't have that collection of tools before he made that. I'm assuming.
He had a lot. Yeah, okay. And it was in there. I think he mentioned that in the interview too. But he did have to make a few. He had to modify a few. But he did have quite a collection. I don't know if you saw the other things that he had on display. Had probably four or five plow planes that were, you know, top notch. They were the center plow, the ivory stuff. It was, you know,
right,
just insane stuff on their own. And you know,
those are other pieces he had made.
It's pretty incredible. Yeah. Yeah. And he actually had them for sale too. So, I don't know if he sold any of them, but, but they're definitely something to look at. That's for sure.
That's really cool. So like, what were the different shops that they expanded into? Was it a more focused feel to some particular thing? If you said Mary and Mike were in the cabinet maker shop, like who was in the other areas? If it was collected like that.
Yeah, it was sort of collected like that. There was some kind of mismatch, I think, just because the venues had grown and they kind of moved to a few people around.
Yeah, it's really expanded. But, I mean,
So they'd taken some of the people that had been in the other places and kind of moved them around just to, I think, you know, just to give a little more space in the main barn, as well as just to allow other people. But like in the blacksmith shop, they had Seth Gould. I don't know if you guys are familiar with his work.
I know the name.
Insane blacksmith or whitesmith. I'm not sure what Peter Ross was out there as well. There was I'm gonna miss it. Black Bear Forge had some stuff at but there was another one too. Another forge name that I'm mistaking now that was out there. So it kind of made sense that they were in a blacksmith shop and there was, you know, anvils and a big press, and it was kind of ideally situated. That was just kind of the same picturesque that you had the right. And then the Greenwood barn was just all open air, and you know, those guys are out there just, you know, flinging chips all over the place, and it's just stuff's happening all the time out there. So it was very the setting was ideal, although the weather was not.
was it really chilly?
It was cold.
It was very chilly. It was probably I don't know, 50 and rainy on Friday, and so it was pretty chilly, and it was cold, but you know, it was all right.
You gotta work up the right sweat people, with those hand tools.
Right? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So yeah. It's as much a marketplace as it is a string of tool demonstrations, right?
Yeah,
I mean, everybody. I mean, I know that the collection of toolmakers that are invited to this are of the boutique type, not all, but some. And then there's some just instructors like Mike. I don't think that he makes any tools, you know, straight up.
I'm sure he's trying to get signups for a school.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this is all, you know, to drum a business in the best way possible. Did you get it? Is it open? I mean, I'm assuming from what I've experienced at the other shows, when I see, like, I've talked to Rainey and I've talked to Mike and a bunch of other guys. But anyway, everyone's approachable. Everyone's you know got their stuff out there, and you can get your hands on every piece of it and try Absolutely. It out if it's possible. I mean, that's the best way to get you to buy something, obviously.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's something I guess I didn't really appreciate the first time I went. It was just. I guess, I don't know. It was sometime shortly after that, there somebody had posted something about a blog post about having an infill plane stolen, not at Handworks, just at another time. And it made me think you had all these very, very high end tools that were just there, just ready. You know, you just walk up and just start messing with them, and nobody, you know, it just felt natural. And it wasn't until much later that I thought, man, that's just scary how much of that was pretty much liquid assets that you could just run off with if you thought about it. But, you know,
and not so much run off. But if you're anything like me, you will never buy a $2,000 infill plane, but you could use one.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll tell you what. You might rethink that equation whenever you're standing there.
I know. It's terrible. You know, I've used a Ron Breeze plane, and I quickly stepped because
it's really nice. Yeah, Ron was there, and he had his tool set up, and they're very nice. Yeah, and you got Scott Meek there with really nice wooden hand planes, and you got
the checkered texturing he's doing.
That's really cool. Yeah, he had some of those there.
What he does to do it, but it looks it's a
gun stock tool that does that. Oh, so that's where the checkering comes from. Yeah. So there's some sort of, and he kind of showed it to me a little bit, and you know, I can't really say that I totally understand how it works, but it's kind of a freehand, but also kind of guided, so that you can get you know, kind of some pattern to it that's regular.
Is it just like a little tap that you're hammering in, you slide it over a little bit, hammer it in again?
Something like that, yeah. But I don't know. It's a really neat. It looks really neat on his planes on the chamfers there. I think it's cool. I hope he sells a lot of
neat. So what stood out to you? And this is admittingly saying that you're a third time attendee. You've seen it grow, all that stuff. But
why should I come out from New York?
Why should you?
Why should Diami travel to Havana?
That's a
Iowa.
Hard one.
a predominantly power tool user from Long Island, New York. Why should that show up next time he's around?
I don't know. I don't know why. I have a hard time saying why Diami should go. I think a lot of. I would say it's definitely if you're interested in those boutique makers. If you're interested in. You know, it's also really cool just to see the community, just the people that, because there was a lot of people that I ran into who were not presenting, not there, but they were all there. And so I got to meet quite a few people, people that I, you know, I've followed on Instagram or followed their blogs for years. And it's just really cool just from a community event. I think in one way it's better because there's not a specific seminar base, you know, say, maybe like the Fine Woodworking Live, the WIA, the Weekend with Wood, those are all based on training, right? So you don't have that. So either that's
classroom instruction, at least.
Yeah. Either that's something you want or not. And I, even though I certainly could benefit from some more classes where I actually got some hands-on instruction, that would be good. But I think that, I'm probably at the point where I've learned a lot from following blogs and podcasts and all that. You know, it's like, I know that my problems are not based on lack of knowledge or not lack of information. and so this event is more about community to me. It was about, you know, getting to meet people and getting to just kind of hang out and probably get to try out some tools I wouldn't normally have in my shop and get to talk to some people who are way better craftsmen than I'll ever be. And, you know, kind of maybe learn something here or there and just go from there. So as far as why you would come out from New York, I don't know that I would say that you should. knowing a little bit more about you than, but you would enjoy it.
I think I would enjoy it. It sounds like it sounds like a great weekend among woodworkers. What
it is.
What's not to enjoy about that?
Right. You could not enjoy it if you were there, but whether or not it'd be worth the expense and hassle and whatever of traveling and getting there and all that stuff.
I'll be honest. The biggest reason why I wouldn't go is because after I fly there, I'd still have to get a rental car. And that might sound petty, but if I think once it's beyond the drivable range, I think it helps if the event is near an airport. Like
what's funny is I talked to, there's one young guy that I talked with, and he was camping there, and he said you could get an Uber from the airport to there, but you could not get an Uber back.
Oh no.
So he had to get he was like leaving super early, and he had to get a taxi, something. I don't know. It was a real hassle to get back. But
and let's be honest, Yami, I've picked you up at the airport for WIA a few times.
Oh, yeah, you have.
You would have no problem.
But I've also taken a taxi from the hotel back to the airport at WIA as many times.
Yeah.
And I would absolutely lean on friends to get a ride. I'm not above bumming a ride. But tell me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of this location is that it's not a quick taxi cab from the Metropolitan Airport to that metropolitan area. It's
Like it'd be 20. I mean, I stayed by the airport, so it was, you know, only 15-20 minute, ride. It's not bad. There was people that were renting cars. There were people that were getting taxis, whatever. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you could bum ride somewhere.
I'll pay closer attention next time.
I'm most certain of that, but
I'm not sure how well those airports are served. I don't know. Now, if you flew into Chicago, then it's a bigger drive. So,
I've learned, the little Midwestern airports it's just a carryover. I'd probably have to transfer in Chicago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
it's like, I would say the other effect is like, it's nice that we have something in the Midwest because everybody says, well, why would I want to go to the Midwest? I'm like, well, I'm in the Midwest and that's where I want it to be. so it's great. Why does everything else have to be on the East Coast to be so far?
if my schedule wasn't just as it was, I would have been there for sure. And I'll drive that distance and it's 8 plus hours for me. I've driven to Des Moines. I can drive to Amana. It's that that's totally reasonable, especially, if it's, I'm literally just paying gas in a hotel. That is even easier because I'm going to probably get as much from, in a different way, but I'm going to get as much from talking to toolmakers and instructors, on a face-to-face basis. Than I would from sitting in a class of 20 listening to an instructor,
Right.
I'd probably get more from Rainey Nelson if I went up to his bench and talked to him. I got a lot from him in class.
Yeah, but I'll tell you,
he has a wealth of knowledge.
Even for somebody who doesn't use his planes, it's probably worth going to Iowa just to talk to Rainey for a little while.
Just to talk to Rainey, absolutely.
I did not get the chance to talk with him this time, but the last time he. That's a funny story with Rainey is that I was talking to him about something and I commented about his charred finish thing and he like stopped. He's like, you got to try this. And so he went, I forget where he tracked down a blowtorch, but he, left his booth, went and got a blowtorch, got some wax and demonstrated it for me right there, and it was like, I was sold and I decided I had to do a lot of that.
You can't buy that. That has to be experienced. It's just that right there is worth the ticket price of zero. sounds like the coolest thing, and I'm glad they continue to do it. Obviously, it's every year and a half. I don't know what it takes Jamil to put this thing together, but I'm sure it's not easy. So
it's got to be a ton of work.
much respect to it. But I'm hoping the next time that I get to attend for sure. I do want to ask one thing. I'll put you on the spot.
Okay.
What would be one thing that you would change, or how could you do you think the event could be improved?
That is a tough question. I think, the easy solution would be that it would be warmer.
Well, we can't control the weather.
Control the weather. And the last time, I think it was pretty hot. So I shouldn't say that.
There you go.
Is it always this time of year?
It's always been
it was, May, right?
Yeah, I think it was. Let me look at the last one. Yeah, the last one was May 15th to 16th, so in 2015. Okay. So as far as improvements, it probably would be good. I think if they could do maybe some activities, they did have, like I mentioned, the Mike Simpson build a Moxen bench. I think if there was maybe a few more kind of events throughout the day, there was Roy put on a presentation in the morning on Saturday. But I think if there was just kind of I'm wanting to think, say you guys participated in something several years ago, like a WIAA or somewhere there was a build a chair or something like that.
The second Fine Woodworking Live, which was 3 or 4 years ago. It was an evening event and I think 10 minutes beforehand, you were told you're going to build seating and you were given a supply of 2x4s. And I think Bosch gave some power tools that you could use and you built it. And then last year at Weekend with Wood, it was a similar activity in that it was a little bit, it wasn't It was a little different in that it wasn't teams designing their own and building it like it was a Fine Woodworking Live, but they had us all build these little free libraries, and you broke up into teams and unofficially were racing to finish it first. and even that, where you weren't these teams designing and coming up with things, but just working together to assemble it, it was a nice bonding activity with the other attendees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, and that's, I think, what it is. And what I would think could be missing is I really appreciated being your the remote correspondent here for NWA.
Yeah, that's something we really haven't mentioned yet in this discussion. But to the listeners, Jeremy was nice enough to walk around there with my extra recorder. And following this episode, we're going to have probably it'll end up being two episodes worth of Jeremy doing six questions with many of the attendees while out there. And you got some really good interviews with these, with the attendees. So thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks. It really was nice because I felt like it gave me permission to go up to talk to people that either I knew or didn't know. And so I think that would be an opportunity to kind of have some forced community for the people that are kind of there and kind of a little timid to go, you know, because, you know, my experience was actually going to the first Handworks in 2013 was that, you know, it's like all these people that I had read their blogs, I'd seen their Instagram posts, and I went and, you know, it's like I knew them, but they didn't know me at all because right. I was a lurker and just kind of mm-hmm. sitting there not really participating. So I was hesitant and didn't really know them. And of course, they were all very friendly, but I kind of felt like an outcast. And so that really spurred me on to kind of get more engaged in the community, to start, you know, start a blog myself and to start kind of like putting myself out there and being more extroverted, which is definitely not my natural style. If you, as an engineer type, it's, I've kind of had to force myself through that to get through there. And I think there's a lot of those people there. So I think if there's some forced mixing activities or, you know, something along those lines, I think that could be an added benefit for those that aren't naturally that way.
Yeah. I mean, it's liquid courage of the best type to have a microphone in hand.
But, it is really,
I, that kind of gets the question in my head. How were we as by extension of you, received there? Did people know of the show? Did they know why they were being interviewed?
There was a few. Yeah. There was, I mean, it was totally well received. Nobody told me no. They did not want to speak with me on the record or anything like that. Some people hadn't heard of Modern Woodworker. Some people knew what it was. A couple people had kind of like approached me and said, "Oh, you're doing that thing for the MWA," and I said, "Yeah, sure. You want to talk?" So, you know, it was really nice. Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think maybe the final question, and I know this is one that Diami cares near and dear about, how was the nightlife?
Nightlife. That is hilarious. Although actually you might be surprised. No, you wouldn't be surprised. I would have to say I really lucked into, I had kind of hit it off with Caleb James. I don't know if you guys know him. Mm-hmm. He's a
chair maker.
Bulk Shaves. Mm-hmm. Yep, chair maker. Yeah. And so we had kind of formed a friendship the last couple of years or whatever. So I finally got to meet him and his family, and my daughter. I got to hang out with his girls, and it was so we had dinner with them. But then by extension, we also got to kind of have dinner with some of the guys from the Greenwood Barn and some of the other guys. And it was really. It was, you know, so then you got in that group and it was just really a great experience. We just all sat in some German restaurant kind of place, and it was had decent food and you know, just sat and talked for a couple hours, and it seemed like, I don't know how long it was, but it was great. It was really nice. So, I mean, I'm sure there was no loud bar scene, but you know, that's not really my thing anyway. So
no, but
there's definitely no nightclubs in Amana.
That's what these things are about, is you sit around with other people and you have a nice conversation.
And talk, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I mean, so at the table over from us, there was Roy Underhill was having dinner with, I can't think of who he was having dinner with, but he was over there having dinner with somebody. And it's just quite a few people that was just kind of in the room. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I hope everyone was previously aware of this event, and if you're like me, you just didn't get to go. but I for sure, I mean, thank you tenfold, please, for, or thank you, not please, but for going there in for us, because I mean, I couldn't make it, and reporting. I can't wait to hear those recordings. Should be awesome. You rock.
Well, yeah, thank you for letting me be a part of the podcast.
Oh, no problem.
It was really nice. It was really nice. And it was, like you said, it was kind of a liquid courage to be able to go up and talk to people that you knew or you didn't know, and just kind of shove a microphone in front of some person that you don't know and just say, tell me about everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I want to gently extend this opportunity in the future with some, you know, it's ultimately Damian's decision if he wants to rent his stuff out to people. But if there are more events that we can't get to, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're looking for. We want to hear about the shows that people are going to.
Absolutely. Know, that we but at this point, I think that unless there's a reason Jeremy doesn't make it, I think Handworks is his beat.
I think so. Our man on location.
I'll happily serve that beat.
Yeah. If we ever do all join up at a single event, you're certainly part of the team.
Absolutely.
All right. All right.
So, Sean.
Well, let's. Yes, sir.
What's next?
So, I mean, I think we've discussed Handworks a good amount. If you have any more questions, hit us up. I'm sure. I mean, there's the information out there. Right now, we don't know when the next one's going to be.
I thought it was just every 2 years. Is it not that?
By history, we could say it's going to be in 2019, but I don't know for sure.
Give me a won't promise anything.
Right. I know you never will. But yeah. If you consider that just 5 years ago, it was one barn, and now it's four different buildings. If they continue to expand like that, which is awesome. I don't know if they'll be able to stay where they are. I mean, it's convenient, I know, for Jamil at least. And it's a quaint village. Yeah. But go ahead.
I think he'll keep it there. I think it's the perfect ideal spot for that.
Yeah, and they made
for what it is. It's really hard to change.
Was there any point where it seemed like there were too many people in any given location?
No. No, not really. I mean,
shoulder.
I would say probably actually the previous one one of the previous ones, the very first one, they had chairs for the Saturday morning presentation, and it was like really packed in there. And last year, two times ago, or you know, whatever the last 2015, there was a lot of people in there for the presentation. Of course, maybe I just got a good seat on this time, so I felt a little bit better. I was up on the Lee Nielsen kind of platform by the railing, so I had a good spot and a good view. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, congested, but it wasn't, I didn't feel like a wall of people by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I think that the main barn was, they had fewer vendors in there kind of because they moved them into the others, a few of them out into some of the other vendors to kind of make a little more breathing room. So I think from the people side, so long as the weather's cooperative, it's, you know, it's a great venue because it basically you just all spread out. Yeah.
No, very, very cool.
Excellent.
So, again, next time it comes around, find your way there. It sounds absolutely awesome.
We can do interviews together, Sean, because
absolutely.
You'll be
absolutely.
There.
Absolutely. And Diami mentioned it, but coming up on our next episode, if not next two episodes, will be the interviews that Jeremy got, the five-plus questions from attendees and presenters, I'm assuming. At Handwork. So I'm personally looking really forward to listening to that. But that, of course, works us right into our Fortnite beer choices. And Diami, because I'm first on the list, I guess I'll go first.
Why don't you? You're gonna recommend one of my beers, so go for it.
Oh no. Well, do you have it in your fridge?
No, I don't. I haven't had it this season yet.
Okay. So actually, you know, the thing that you posted the other day about Dogfish giving beer away at the end of a run. I know you love the idea that people run and then drink. but that's Sequench, and I love Sequench.
I've not had it yet. I've stayed away from it because it's a ghost. But
It is. It's all my thing. But I looked and I couldn't find it. And so I don't know if it hasn't gotten to me yet, if it's been recently released or whatnot. But what I did get was Dogfish Head's blood and
flesh and blood.
Yeah, Flesh and Blood IPA, which is a blood orange IPA, which it's good. It's mild as far as their IPAs go.
Yeah, no, it's a good summer. It's a good summer beer.
It is. It really is. It goes down smooth, and it just got that nice sweetness of. It's not sweet by any means, but the blood orange.
Do you guys get the original Citradelic out there? Not this year. They seem to have like a watermelon and a lime version of it. Just the original. I want to say it's tangerine. I don't remember what the fruit is in the original Citradelic.
I think so. Now you're going to make me question next time. I'll look next time and see.
Because
I know I've had Citradelic before, and it wasn't. I don't think it was a skewed flavor, but
I find that it's tangerine. The original Citradelic is tangerine.
Okay.
The Flesh and Blood is really good, but I think the Citradelic does it better.
Okay.
As much as it pains me to say that Dogfish Head is not the best in that class, but in terms of a fruity summer IPA, I prefer the Citradelic.
Yeah, and it's nowhere near a Shandy.
No.
Not IPA, but that I think is an important distinction to make because it is not. It's not bad.
It's quite good. It's so much that's not bad. It's good.
It's so so not bad. It's good. So what about you? What do you got?
I'm drawing from the reserves I brought back from Vermont about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen it outside of my trip to Vermont, but it's Fiddlehead Brewing. And it's their second fiddle double IPA. And it's amazingly smooth for a double IPA.
What does it come at it? Do you know the numbers on it? IBUs or even
they don't care about ABV in Vermont. Well, okay, let me just – what I learned that the entire state of Vermont has the most breweries per capita, and they all make an IPA and a double IPA, and that seems to be all the things they make.
Okay.
When I bought Saisons there, they stopped me and made sure I knew what a Saison was because apparently people only go there for IPAs.
Do they make good Saisons too?
I bought four. I've only had one of them so far. It was exceptional, but it was made in Rhode Island. I just bought it in Vermont. Anyway, the second fiddle comes in at 8.5%. So for a double IPA, it's right where you'd expect it to be.
Yep.
The other ratings are not on the can, and I'm not going to bother to look it up right now. I'll just tell you that it is very smooth. It has a subtle citrusy flavor to it. It's a very good, very drinkable double IPA.
Excellent. Excellent. And Jeremy, if you didn't know it was coming, do you have a beer selection?
I did know it was coming. Because I had to be the voice of reason on this show.
Uh-oh.
Because IPAs are terrible. Terrible, terrible. And there's no reason anybody would ever want to drink them. For somebody, please listen to me.
Do
you
know Paul Thurrott?
No, I don't. I don't yet. But man, IPAs are all over the place. But man, I cannot stand them. I don't know what's the word. Anyway, so my beer choice tonight is, and I'm going to have to, I'm going to butcher the name here. Weihenstephaner, maybe? It's like a really long German name. Weihenstephaner. It's a Hefe Weissbier. It's not a Hefeweizen. It's a wheat beer. It's a German wheat beer, and I really like that. It was really nice tonight. Normally, probably my normal summer beer would be like a Hoegaarden or something like that, just kind of an overall beer. Now that hoppy's junk.
This is not hoppy. If you can get Flesh and Blood, try it. If you can get a single, try it so you're not stuck with a sixer if you don't like it. But seriously, try it because it really, really is. It's not hoppy. IPA has that thing of like, oh my God, it's going to strip my tongue and be pint or whatever, you know. And it really isn't any of that. It's just it's an ale. It's got a little more bite than Budweiser, but it's got, you know.
I'm not even going to touch that comment, Sean.
Okay. There you go. It's not even on the same playing field by any means, but yeah, it's a nothing. I mean, I guess don't shade away. I'm not. I do like them, but I kind of like all now at this point. But I love a good German wit.
And that's my summer beer. Probably my winter beer is like a oatmeal stout kind of thing. That's what I normally go for. But it's a little bit hot for oatmeal stout in my mind. So yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's more of a need to warm up because it's cool kind of thing.
Yeah.
I do have that Founders KBS. I still haven't cracked open. Oh. I may hold that until fall. Just let it age on in the basement shelf for a while. That'll be good. So, Jeremy, again, thank you for being our man on the scene. Where can people find you?
Let's see. I am most active on Instagram at JMAWWorks. That's my four initials, I guess. And I do also have a similar blog by the same name. So you can see me over there, but I don't really post nearly as much as I do on Instagram. And that's pretty much it.
Okay. And I am Sean, W78. I'm Sean. The Corner Workshop, which is my ill-visited blog. But I'm at SeanW78 on most social medias, including Untappd. And you can find me on Facebook, and I'll share that thing before I forget today. And if you hear this, it was days ago, but whatever. The Sindelar Museum visit, I've got a bunch of pictures taken with my Palm Pre because it was 2011. That was a very, very cool experience.
That was a really good trip. Yeah.
And I am Diami Plotky of the penultimatewoodshop.com. I'm at Diami Plotky on the Twitter and the Facebook. And since we skipped this part, I want to thank everyone for listening to the Modern Woodworkers Association. If you like the show, be sure to visit modernwoodworkersassociation.com. Follow the MWA on Twitter at MWA_national. You can like the MWA on Facebook or circle Modern Woodworkers Association on Google+. And the best thing you can do is tell a friend, because word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion. So with that, on behalf of Jeremy and Sean, we want to thank you for listening, and we'll see you in the middle of Iowa.
All right.